KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We're proud of these colors, you know, like the same way I'm proud of the red, white, and blue. This keeps me close to my heritage.
The flag of Mexico has become a symbol of the protests against immigration raids in Los Angeles.
How conservatives are responding to that this Wednesday, June 11th on All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, a closer look at the language President Trump and right-wing media are using to describe what's happening in L.A.
These are paid insurrectionists or agitators or troublemakers. You can call it whatever you want.
Also, some states are figuring out ways to encourage homeowners to make their houses more resilient against natural disasters.
One of the challenges with fire hardening is that it matters what your neighbors do too.
And we remember Brian Wilson, the man who started the Beach Boys.
Those stories and much more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. NPR has learned the Department of Justice has made a sweeping demand for Colorado's election records. NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports documents show the DOJ asked Colorado to turn over all records from the 2024 federal elections and to preserve any records it still has from 2020.
Several voting experts and officials told NPR that broad of a request is highly unusual and concerning given President Trump's false claims about elections. Jenna Griswold is Colorado's Democratic Secretary of State.
We are seeing them use the apparatus of the federal government to undermine our elections and our democracy, and I would assume that this is more of the same.
The Justice Department indicated it had received a complaint. Colorado was not complying with federal record retention rules. The department declined to provide additional details. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
A federal judge has ruled the Trump administration cannot continue to detain Mahmoud Khalil on the basis of Secretary of State Marco Rubio's determination he's a threat to American foreign policy goals. It's unclear whether Khalil will soon be released from the immigration detention center in Louisiana, where he's been held since ICE agents arrested him in early March. Judge paused his own ruling until Friday to give the government time to appeal. France and Saudi Arabia are gathering countries for a conference next week at UN headquarters in New York to support the recognition of a Palestinian state, but major Western countries are not expected to recognize Palestinian statehood yet. More from NPR's Dana Lestrin.
Ofer Bronstein, the French president's advisor on Israeli-Palestinian relations, tells NPR he expects Belgium, Luxembourg, Malta, Croatia, and Greece to recognize Palestinian statehood at the conference next week. He says France, the UK, Canada, Japan, and other economic powerhouses are expected to pledge that they'll recognize a state of Palestine when the Gaza war ends, so that they can try to convince Arab and Muslim countries like Indonesia and Syria to recognize Israel. The U.S. objects to this initiative and won't participate in the UN conference. The Israeli government says Palestinian statehood recognition would reward Hamas. Israel says it could retaliate against the move. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Inflation ticked up last month, though still not by a huge amount. The Labor Department announcing its closely watched consumer price index rose a tenth of a percent from April to 2.4%. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
Some costs are still going up, like rent, but not as fast as it was. There was a sizable jump in grocery prices, but egg prices continue to come down, which is a welcome relief for lots of folks. Airline tickets and new and used cars also got cheaper last month. What we don't see in this inflation report is a lot of extra expenses tied to the president's worldwide tariffs, even though May was the first full month those import taxes were in effect.
NPR's Scott Horsley. On Wall Street today, the Dow was down a point. The Nasdaq fell 99 points. This is NPR. Search engine giant Google, which has essentially been cutting employees since 2023, said to be seeking to offer voluntary buyouts to more of its U.S. workers. The company completed its largest layoffs ever that year, cutting about 12,000 jobs. It's not clear how many workers the company is looking to shed this time. Google is eliminating positions as it seeks to spend billions of dollars on further development of artificial intelligence technologies. A legal win has put a familiar face back in the top five on the Billboard Albums chart. NPR's Stephen Thompson says this week's full of perennial chart favorites.
Morgan Wallen holds at number one with I'm the Problem, while the K-pop band Seventeen and pop star Miley Cyrus debut in the top five with their latest albums. Taylor Swift is in the top five too, which is nothing new. But how she got there is unusual. It follows her announcement that she'd purchased the masters for her first six albums, including 2017's Reputation. What you just made me do, look what you just made me do. Reputation leaps from number 78 to number 5, not because of any new songs or fresh physical additions. It's back in the top 5 because Taylor Swift got some good news. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Entertainment giants Disney and Universal are entering the legal fray when it comes to the use of generative AI. At issue is the use of copyrighted materials. A lawsuit filed in federal court in Los Angeles accuses the company Midjourney of pirating the libraries of the two Hollywood studios to generate and distribute unauthorized copies of their famed characters. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. We begin this hour here in Los Angeles, where things are relatively calm after days of protests over immigration raids and a highly controversial decision by President Trump to send in the National Guard and the U.S. Marines. NPR's Liz Baker joins us now from the Federal Building in downtown L.A., which has been a focal point for the protests and the police response. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Elsa.
So what are things looking like right now where you are?
Well, as you mentioned, it's pretty calm right now, but even at its most chaotic over here, these protests have been contained to a relatively small part of downtown. LAPD says that yesterday they arrested over 200 people. Most of those were for failure to disperse. Federal prosecutors say they charged at least 9 people over unrest in LA. 2 of them were for allegedly having Molotov cocktails. But last night's curfew helped keep people off the streets. It was quieter, and now businesses are taking the opportunity to clean up a little bit from all the graffiti. I spoke with George Sanchez. He's a volunteer with a group painting over some of that vandalism in Little Tokyo. He's also a retired service member, and so I asked him what he thinks of the military deployment.
It's going to scare people more, and it's going to make them want to do more stuff.
He also says he often cleans up graffiti after things like Dodgers games or Lakers games, and this damage is comparable to that. And that's what a lot of people have been saying here, that despite some dramatic footage, these protests are not too big for the city to handle.
Right. Okay. Well, the White House says the relative calm right now is because of President Trump's decision to send troops to the city. What are people here in LA telling you about that claim?
Well, it's confusing. I mean, the mayor and other city officials have been openly perplexed at why the National Guard is here. I can see some National Guard stationed outside the entrance to this federal building. We know they've been tasked with guarding some federal properties, but today there's really almost no one here, and the road that runs right next to this building is open to normal traffic.
That is NPR's Liz Baker in downtown Los Angeles. Thank you, Liz.
You're welcome.
And in these ongoing protests against ICE immigration raids in Los Angeles, the flag of Mexico has emerged as a symbol for many demonstrators. That has provoked strong criticism from top Republicans and many conservatives. NPR's Adrian Florido spoke with LA protesters about why they're waving that symbol now.
On conservative media outlets, there's been a steady stream of outrage all week. This is Fox News' Jesse Waters.
Anarchists and dirt bikes are waving Mexican flags around L.A. while the city's engulfed in flames. And they love this country so much that they're waving the flag. This doesn't look like assimilation. This looks like what it is, an invasion.
But on the streets of Los Angeles, protesters are shrugging off that criticism.
They can attack all they want. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change the fact that we're going to be waving the Mexican flag.
That's Jesus, who was waving a giant Mexican flag over a freeway overpass. He asked us to use only his first name because he fears online retaliation. He said his flag is an expression of pride in his family's history.
I'm proud of my Mexican heritage, you know. Even though it was several generations ago, my family members were immigrants, you know. And obviously, if you come from immigrant family members, you have to have respect for them.
Another protester, Cristina Carrion Ramos, says she is a proud Mexican American. She was wearing her Mexican flag like a cape and said every time she sees its green, white, and red bars and its golden eagle, she feels a surge of emotion.
The colors, like, son colores que tenemos de orgullo. So, like, we're proud of these colors, you know, like, the same way I'm proud of the red, white, and blue. This keeps me close to my heritage.
She says she felt compelled to bring out her Mexican flag because she feels that President Trump's deportation campaign is sending a message that if you aren't white or native-born, you can't be American. She rejects that.
There's nothing that I can be told that will make me not proud of who I am.
This is not the first time immigrant rights protesters have been told not to wave the Mexican flag. But the criticism hasn't always come from the right. There have also been divisions on this within the immigrant rights movement. Pedro Rios remembers the massive protests that overtook Los Angeles and other American cities in 2006 when House Republicans passed a restrictive immigration bill that ultimately failed. The protests started small with high school students walking out of class and waving Mexican flags. But by the time hundreds of thousands of people marched in Los Angeles weeks later, it was a sea of red, white, and blue. Rios, a longtime immigrant rights advocate, says the large immigrant and Latino rights groups organizing those protests made a conscious decision.
These established organizations were saying don't wave flags of other countries, especially the Mexican flag.
It was a strategic choice to gain national support for immigrant-friendly reform.
The message of waving the U.S. flag was one of we are part of the fabric of the U.S., we can assimilate, we can fit into the larger narrative.
The reform advocates wanted never passed. Over the years, anti-immigrant rhetoric has only taken deeper hold within the nation's politics. Rios says that today, protesters no longer see the point in hiding where their families came from. They now assert it with pride. Laura is one of those protesters. She gave me only her first name because she did not want to endanger her parents, who live here without legal status. She brought a flag to the LA protests that reflect both her identities, Mexican eagle in the middle, stars and stripes on the side.
It is a statement that I do belong here, and it doesn't matter if they don't want us here because of the way that we look. We do belong, and we equally belong as much as, you know, anybody else.
The fact that I have Mexican roots, she says, doesn't change the fact that I'm a U.S. citizen. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Los Angeles.
A great American rock musician has died. Brian Wilson, co-founder of the Beach Boys, was 82 years old. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports Wilson rocketed the pop song into new dimensions with hits like California Girls and Love and Mercy.
Brian Wilson sold an entire generation on the myth of California beach culture with hooky, harmony-rich songs like Surfing USA. Everybody's gonna Catch a Wave.
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world.
And California Girls.
I wish they all could be California. I wish they all.
Despite being a son of Southern California, Wilson did not surf. He even admitted to being a little afraid of the ocean in 1988 on WHYY's Fresh Air.
I have an aversion to water. I don't know what it is.
But Wilson was always drawn to music. He loved Chuck Berry, George Gershwin, and Frank Sinatra, and as a kid listened deeply to a Midwestern group that subverted barbershop quartet conventions, the Four Freshmen.
Day by day, I'm falling more in love with you.
Whenever I hear Freshmen songs, I'd sing along with the high note, you know, and I got into a habit of singing high.
In 1961, he formed the Beach Boys with brothers Dennis and Carl Wilson, their cousin Mike Love, and friend Al Jardine.
I'm getting bug driving up and down the same old strip.
The group was known for its dense vocal harmonies. Brian Wilson soared on the top line, as he told Terry Gross.
So then I started saying, hey, I sound like a girl up here. So I got into it.
Beach Boys went on to score a string of perky top 10 singles. Wilson's abusive, controlling father, Murray, managed the group. He had failed to make it as a musician himself. The pressure he put on his eldest son got to be too much. Brian Wilson had a mental breakdown. He stopped touring with the band and started doing a lot of drugs. But in 1966, in the middle of his sadness and solitude, Wilson turned out what is widely recognized today as one of the world's greatest rock albums, Pet Sounds. Pet Sounds sealed Wilson's reputation as a musical mastermind and set off a friendly rivalry with the Beatles, who responded the following year with the madly experimental album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. A scene in the 2014 biopic Love and Mercy dramatizes Brian Wilson's creative process on Pet Sounds. A studio musician struggles with the composer's unorthodox key choices.
Brian?
Yeah?
I think you might have screwed up here.
Really? Let me see.
Well, you've got Lyle playing in D and the rest of us are in A major.
Yeah, that's right.
How does that work? Two bass lines and two different keys?
Well, it works in my head.
Wilson's head dreamed up not just Pet Sounds in 1966, but also the single Good Vibrations. I'm picking up good vibrations. But despite his commercial and critical success, the artist was suffering from hallucinations and depression. He became deeply reclusive in the 1970s and gained a lot of weight. Wilson's then wife hired a controversial psychotherapist to pull her spouse out of his slump. A tough round-the-clock diet and exercise regimen got Wilson back into shape and into the music studio. He released his first self-titled solo album in 1988. The psychotherapist, Eugene Landy, started to control more and more of Wilson's life, what he ate, where he went, who he saw. Landy even received writing and producing credits on a couple of Wilson's solo albums. The musician's family eventually forced Landy out, as Wilson recalled on NPR in 2016.
I had no power over him. He had power over me.
Wilson remarried in the mid-1990s and slowly began to recover from years of darkness. In his later years, he recorded a George Gershwin tribute album. It's wonderful, it's marvelous, you should care for me. And performed on a reunion album and tour with the Beach Boys. That's why God made the radio. Brian Wilson cracked open pop music and extracted not just good vibrations, but great ones. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at Subaru.com/care. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Since the protests in Los Angeles against President Trump's deportation policies began, the White House has used specific language to describe what's happening. Here is how Trump phrased it yesterday.
These are paid insurrectionists or agitators or troublemakers. You can call it whatever you want.
NPR's Lisa Hagan has been monitoring how the rhetoric around these protests could reshape the national debate over immigration. Hey there.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So I understand you have been spending a lot of time online, social media accounts, looking around at pro-Trump media spaces. And so I want to start by asking, is what you were seeing there, the descriptions of these protests, is it echoing the president's terminology?
Absolutely. The two words I'm hearing the most are insurrection and invasion. There's been a lot of focus on images of demonstrators waving foreign flags. Here's some examples from former White House advisor Steve Bannon and right-wing activist Charlie Kirk.
You see the Mexican flags? You see the Palestinian flags? This is a war.
This is what invading armies do. They wave their flags. Los Angeles does not feel like a protest.
So obviously invasions and insurrections are different things, but they are getting blended across right-wing media right now. And together, those are terms that could potentially criminalize any protester, U.S. citizen or not.
Huh. Although I will note that we have heard President Trump using the word invasion in the same sentence as immigration for ages, for years. Are you hearing it used differently now?
You're right. It is usually used to describe asylum seekers and gangs, but that's been changing, according to First Amendment litigator Ken White.
Okay.
He was saying this term, Trump has already invoked the Alien Enemies Act to try to suspend due process for Venezuelan immigrants he's accused of being gang members.
The conceit here is that people who are here illegally are part of an enemy invading force, like an army.
And he says Trump is now using these protests to broaden that category.
He also seems to be trying to use rhetoric that would be a justification for uses of tools like the Insurrection Act or for his asserted broader executive power to do pretty much whatever he wants to do.
Hmm. So, Lisa, we're hearing here about a couple of the relevant laws that are in play. The Alien Enemies Act you mentioned, Trump has already invoked that. He has not invoked, at least not yet, the Insurrection Act, which we just heard White refer to there. Remind us what the Insurrection Act does, what would trigger it?
So parts of it are actually quite vague and open to interpretation. Essentially, it would allow the president to use the armed forces to take any measures he considers necessary to suppress an insurrection. Here's White again.
You'll hear the administration trying to echo those words. Well, we say it's an insurrection, therefore the Insurrection Act applies.
He says it's a power that really hasn't been through a lot of legal testing. So just like with the Alien Enemies Act, the courts would have a lot to try to untangle. So media coverage and framing by the administration will have some impact on how courts evaluate whatever measures Trump may take, whether it's in L.A. or somewhere else.
Fascinating. So an open question. What else is catching your eye as you poke around on these websites and look at what pro-Trump media figures and influencers are posting?
So on Monday, we saw some very high-profile MAGA influencers, Charlie Kirk, who we already heard from, right-wing filmmaker Matt Walsh, and Jack Posobiec, all post nearly identical messages to, quote, ban all third-world immigration, legal or illegal, unquote. That's a departure from the longtime Republican framing on immigration, which is usually like some version of we don't hate immigrants, we just want them to come here legally.
And here's Lisa Hagan. Thank you.
Thank you.
At the center of the big, ugly split between President Trump and Elon Musk is the cost of the president's signature domestic policy bill. The GOP mega bill is estimated to add trillions to the deficit, and that's putting new focus on Republicans and their rhetoric about fiscal conservatism. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has more.
In the fight for GOP fiscal restraint, Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey is often one of the last men standing on Capitol Hill.
Because I'm the only one who'll speak the truth.
The longtime fiscal hawk wears a smart badge on his suit pocket that tracks the national debt live.
The time I don't wear it here in D.C. is when I'm sleeping.
Last month, Massey was the only House Republican to vote against his party's massive spending package. And that debt clock, which now sits at more than $36 trillion, explains why.
So what's going to happen if the big, beautiful bill passes is my debt badge will take a jump up.
The GOP would extend the tax cuts passed during President Trump's first term while also spending big on immigration, defense, and other party priorities. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates the plan will add $2.4 trillion to deficits over the next decade. Republicans argue the analysis ignores the economic growth they expect the bill to generate. That pushback aside, some experts say deficit spending is a familiar tune for the GOP.
The party tends to enact major tax cuts that aren't balanced out by spending cuts.
That's Boston College politics professor Dave Hopkins. He says being a fiscal conservative is much easier in the minority, since that just means attacking Democrats on spending. But it's more complicated in the majority, where he says the GOP has a history of overspending.
It was true in the Nixon era. It was true in the Reagan era. It was true in George W. Bush's time. And it's once again true in the Donald Trump era.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul agrees the majority party often forgets about fiscal restraint, so he plans to vote against the Senate measure because it would approve an extra $4 trillion in repayment on debt the government already owes.
When your party's in charge, some people fall away and just want to support whatever sort of the team is doing as opposed to remembering the primary problem really is the debt.
Republicans have shown a new appetite for raising the debt ceiling. When Congress last raised it 2 years ago, 71 House Republicans voted no. Last month, virtually all voted to support the move, with Massey as the lone exception. A big reason for the switch? President Trump, who isn't known for fiscal restraint. Last month, he praised a Massachusetts Democratic senator for calling to eliminate the debt limit altogether.
I agree with Elizabeth Warren on that. I think you should get rid of it. It's too catastrophic.
Hopkins says Trump has drawn new GOP voters less motivated by the size of the government and more focused on cultural issues. But that creates a new challenge. To pay for the bill, Republicans are looking to cut back on programs used by many in their new base. Programs like Medicaid, the joint federal-state health care program for low-income, elderly, and disabled Americans. According to Congress's scorekeeper, the bill could force an estimated 11 million to lose their health coverage.
To what extent are the Republicans risking alienating many of their new constituencies if they pursue cuts to programs that those constituencies tend to favor and to some extent directly benefit from?
It's a question that could help decide the country's fiscal outlook, as well as whether Republicans will stay in power. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is NPR News. After one hurricane after another in recent years, some Florida businesses learned to deal with flooding in a new way by putting appliances on higher ground and just letting the water in.
We're going to open the front door, open the back door, let the water flow through, because we've learned if we have movement of the water, the mud doesn't stick around.
This week, we're reporting on ways people are finding climate solutions. Hear more tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump's big, beautiful bill makes big cuts to federal employee retirement benefits.
It's a thankless job sometimes, but, you know, we're going to stick it out because we believe in what we do.
How federal employees are feeling about it after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. In New York, a federal appeals court heard arguments today in President Trump's ongoing legal fight to erase his criminal conviction. The case involved hush money payments to an adult film star just ahead of the 2016 election. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf was in the courtroom today.
This hearing was all about whether Trump's case, which was prosecuted in state court, can be moved to federal court, even after sentencing. The president's legal team argued essentially that prosecutors relied on evidence in trial related to Trump's official acts as president, and therefore this should be a federal case, even though the crime itself was committed while Trump was still a candidate in 2016. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office maintains it should stay with the state. A three-judge panel peppered both sides with questions, sometimes skeptical, sometimes open. All noted the unusual nature of this case, as no U.S. president had ever been convicted of a crime before. The panel will issue a ruling at a later date. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, New York.
Well, as protests over mass arrests during immigration raids spreads across the country, the mayor of Los Angeles is calling for another overnight curfew covering 1 square mile of the city's downtown. Police detained more than 100 people last night for curfew violations to stop vandalism and theft by agitators looking to cause trouble. Mayor Karen Bass says President Trump's deployment of National Guard troops and the Marines is only inflaming tensions.
When you start deploying federalized troops on the heels of these raids, it is a drastic and chaotic escalation and completely unnecessary.
LA police have made almost 400 arrests since Saturday in connection with the immigration protests. ICE agents are rounding up people in other parts of the country as well, with similar protests happening in New York, Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, and San Antonio, Texas, just to name a few. This is NPR News. As AI companions gain popularity, some folks are using them for emotional support. But as NPR's Windsor Johnston tells us, experts warn that digital relationships may come with hidden costs.
AI romance is having a moment. These mates are attentive, emotionally available, and entirely fictional. Psychologist Lori Gottlieb says that's part of the appeal.
The bot is very predictable. The bot is going to be there for you in the way that you hope.
Chatbots are great listeners. They mimic intimacy. But Gottlieb says something's missing.
There are no shared experiences. It's just the two of you in a bubble of validation. And that's going to start to feel really empty. It might feel comforting, like a nice blanket.
That blanket feels good and keeps you warm in the night. But in real life, Gottlieb says, it's not a relationship that carries with you into your day. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
The Trump administration is set to roll back federal regulations that limit greenhouse gases, mercury, and other toxic pollutants from power plants that are fueled by coal and natural gas. Environmental groups are vowing to challenge the changes in court. All this is part of President Trump's pledge to, quote, unleash American energy and make it more affordable for consumers and businesses. Stocks finished lower across the board on Wall Street today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Home insurance is getting more expensive across the country as climate change and natural disasters get more intense. But many homeowners have not strengthened or retrofitted their houses to reduce the damage. Lauren Sommer from NPR's Climate Desk and Stephen Basaha from the Gulf States Newsroom report on how some states are developing a new strategy to help homeowners protect their properties. It's part of our week-long look at climate solutions.
From the outside, there's nothing really remarkable about Ron Watson's roof.
Watson lives in Spanish Fort, Alabama, just a short drive from the Gulf Coast. And yeah, his roof looks like you'd expect. Gray shingles, bit of a slant.
But this roof is saving Watson money. It reduces the cost of his insurance premium. And premiums are going up around the country.
That's a big incentive. I mean, homeowners insurance now has been through the roof because of the storms we've had through here.
Hurricanes on the Gulf are getting more intense as the climate gets hotter.
So are wildfires in the western U.S. and severe storms in the Midwest. Costlier disasters mean more payouts for insurance companies as homes get damaged or destroyed.
So companies are raising premiums as the financial risk gets worse. From 2021 to 2024, premiums for a typical homeowner went up 24% on average, according to a report by the Consumer Federation of America.
But there are things homeowners can do to reduce the damage from disasters and the insurance claims that have to be paid out, which is what Watson's roof is all about. It's been strengthened. It's less likely to be damaged when hurricane force winds hit.
Getting a good certified roof is a lot. Watching them do it, I realized, man, all the ones I had done before wasn't near as good as this one is.
To find out what makes this roof so much stronger, I talked to Kendall Duke. She's a contractor with Fortified Exteriors, which installed Watson's roof. We spoke on one of Mobile's many rainy days, and she says that rain is half the danger from these storms. The other half is the high winds that strip away a roof.
If your roof starts going, even just a couple shingles, it's just kind of a ripple effect from there.
That lets the rain inside, which can start to rot things from the drywall to the family photos.
So to counter that 1-2 punch, Alabama adopted a 1-2 defense. It's called a fortified roof, basically a construction benchmark for making roofs storm ready.
First, there's a waterproof stick-on layer.
If for some reason a shingle does blow off, you're still not going to get water into your house because the roof underneath is fully sealed on the decking.
So it's a really expensive waterproof sticker at the end of the day.
Pretty much, yeah.
Then there are these special nails with ridges running down the side. It makes them much more resistant to wind. That's what Fortified Exteriors is installing on a home in Mobile.
Alabama encourages homeowners to get roofs like this with grants of up to $10,000 to help with the cost. And the other big incentive is that discount on your insurance.
In Alabama, if you have a fortified roof, you get a discount of 20 to 35% off the wind portion of your premium, which for many people is the bulk of their insurance premium. That can be hundreds of dollars a year.
Alabama pioneered this program after state legislators passed a law to create it in 2012. State officials say more than 50,000 roofs in the state are now fortified. And other states are copying it. Louisiana and Mississippi have started their own insurance discount programs. And it's spreading to states with other kinds of disasters, too.
But in some, it's not quite as popular, like California. That's where I met homeowner Elizabeth Stage in Oakland. She doesn't have to picture what a wildfire would do to her neighborhood because she's seen it.
The 91 fire got within two houses of mine. House next door was unscathed, and the one past that was completely charred on one side.
She's talking about the Oakland Hills fire. That fire burned more than 3,000 houses in 1991. Stage thinks about the risk of wildfires a lot. So a few years ago, when she was planning some home maintenance projects, she wanted to make her house more resistant to fires.
If you look here.
And she's done a lot. She paid extra for building materials that have been shown to make a difference in a wildfire.
The deck used to be made out of redwood.
Now it's made of Trex, a composite material that's less likely to ignite. The siding isn't wood anymore. The roof is fire resistant.
The windows have been replaced. It's some kind of tempered glass.
Tempered glass is less likely to shatter in the heat from a wildfire, which lets the flames into your home.
Now she's looking to get a discount from her insurance company, like homeowners in Alabama get for their fortified roofs.
But the discounts in California are lower than in Alabama. Stage's insurance company could only knock off up to 15%. That's at the upper end for what's offered in California. Some companies only offer 8%, and homeowners have to pay for an inspection. California's insurance regulators say those discounts could go up as the program develops, but I talked to other homeowners who say right now it's just not enough to motivate them to do expensive home projects.
Now, there are some key differences between the states. Michael Wara studies climate risk at Stanford University. He says it's just simpler to change out a roof.
The benefits of a super roof are fully captured by the person that makes the investment. One of the challenges with fire hardening is that it matters what your neighbors do too.
Even if a homeowner does everything right, their house can still be at risk if their neighbors don't because of the way fire spreads. So insurance companies may not see a reason to give a big discount unless entire neighborhoods work together to be safer. But for homeowners like Stage, the biggest motivation isn't a discount.
It would be frosting on the cake. Before I worry about my premiums, I need to worry about my non-renewal notice.
Homeowners in California are being dropped by their insurance companies. Nationwide, almost 2 million people lost insurance from 2018 to 2023, according to a report from the Senate Budget Committee. And it can be hard to find affordable insurance once you lose it.
But replacing your roof in Alabama or getting rid of wood siding in California doesn't guarantee you can keep your insurance. That's because insurance companies aren't required to consider those things. Dave Jones, a former insurance commissioner of California, says that's a problem.
Getting a discount is nice, but the discount doesn't matter a darn if the insurer won't renew or write your insurance.
State regulators do not have the power to make insurers consider these disaster preparations when deciding who to insure. It would take state lawmakers to do that.
But with millions of homes at risk from wildfires, storms, and hurricanes, Jones says insurance should be sending the right signals to motivate people and help make entire communities better protected. I'm Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
And from the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Stephen Bisaha.
Climate Solutions Week continues on All Things Considered tomorrow, when a group of neighbors all go in for solar power together.
Support for NPR's Climate Solutions Week Rethinking Home comes from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's a small device, but the hype around it is huge. The technology is called constant glucose monitoring, and companies that make it say it will transform the way you feel. But what do scientific studies say? Michaeline Duclef finds out.
The monitor is about the size of a quarter, and it sticks to the back of your arm. Every few minutes or so, it sends a signal to your phone estimating the concentration of sugar in your blood. Elizabeth Selvin at Johns Hopkins University says this technology is super helpful for managing diabetes.
For patients and the families of people with type 1 diabetes, I mean, it's been, you know, truly revolutionary.
Helping people avoid dangerously low blood sugar. But last year, the FDA approved the first over-the-counter versions of continuous glucose monitors for people without diabetes. The idea is that they may help people lose weight and improve their overall health. Sarah Berry is a nutritionist at King's College London and chief scientist at the company Zoe, which distributes the monitors. She says everyone has blood sugar spikes when they eat carbohydrates.
Peaks and troughs in glucose is a normal physiological response to consuming carbohydrates.
But problems can arise when these surges are too big for too long.
Having really high levels over a long period of time can increase your risk of some chronic diseases.
Like heart disease, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. So in theory, a continuous glucose monitor could help people lower their blood sugar levels and reduce their risk for these problems. Several studies have tested that theory. Colin Popp, a nutritionist at New York University, helped to lead one of them. That study found that on average, the glucose monitors did not help people lower their blood sugar very much at all.
We actually found no real effect. We didn't find any significant results.
And the monitoring didn't help people lose weight any better than simply following a traditional low-fat diet. But Pop says those negative findings were the average outcome and not the full story.
Some people did really well. We had individuals coming back to us being like, you changed my life. I lost 30 pounds. I feel great.
While others in the study gained weight. So scientists are now trying to figure out who benefits from this technology. Karen Kennedy, a private nutritionist, says the devices help some people make a big discovery about themselves. They're extremely sensitive to carbohydrates, even the healthy ones.
Brown rice, quinoa, beans, grains, every time they eat it, their blood sugar goes too high, and it's consistently that way.
Then, if they eat fewer carbohydrates,
their blood sugar comes down dramatically, they feel better, they lose visceral fat.
And she says, when you wear the glucose monitor, you log what you eat. This helps people be more aware of how different foods impact their blood sugar.
They're like, oh, when I eat this, my blood sugar goes up. And if I don't, it doesn't. And as soon as they change it, they're like, oh, that's an improvement.
And that improvement motivates some people to eat better. Each device lasts about 2 weeks and costs about $50. But if you're thinking of buying one, NYU's Colin Popp warns that the data can often be confusing for a lot of people.
If you give someone a bunch of data and they don't know what to do with it, what's the point?
So he says there needs to be more guidance and education about this new technology. For NPR News, I'm Michaeline Duclef.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In Florida, the number of deportations is growing, and that is raising concerns among some of President Trump's most loyal voters, Cuban Americans. Before last year's election, more than two-thirds of Cuban Americans in Miami-Dade County said that they supported Trump. But now, some of them are criticizing the Trump administration's recent immigration actions. Here's NPR's Greg Allen.
If you want a quick cup of Cuban coffee and some conversation, you can find it at one of Miami's many ventanitas. Those are the counter service windows serving customers outside bakeries and restaurants, like this one in Miami's Westchester neighborhood. Roger Schaefer is a second-generation Cuban American, and he says a Trump supporter 100%. But he's not comfortable with how the Trump administration is cracking down on people living here without legal status.
I was on board with deporting any criminal. Not so much people that come to work hard and roofers and construction guys. I'm not for deporting people without criminal records.
In Florida and around the country, immigration and customs enforcement officers are detaining and beginning deportation proceedings against people with no criminal violations, in some cases arresting them at routine check-ins or immigration hearings. Those stories in Spanish and English language media are generating a lot of attention and talk in Miami-Dade County. It's a place where nearly 7 out of 10 people are Hispanic, and more than half of the residents came here from another country. George Pita, whose parents came from Honduras and Uruguay, says he's been following the stories and the debate closely.
It's rough because I'm Hispanic myself, and I see my people like this, being treated like this. I'm in agreement with having to deport massively because a lot of illegals did come through. I just don't like the way it's being done.
Like others I spoke to, PETA is critical of the protests in Los Angeles, where he believes people are siding with immigrants who entered the country illegally over law enforcement authorities. But he's not happy with the administration's approach.
And I voted for the guy because I like him. I do think Trump also has his mistakes that he needs to address. Foreign policy is one. The way he handled this immigration is not good.
Abel Delgado, who heads Miami-Dade County's Democratic Hispanic Caucus, says the Trump administration has shocked the community by deporting people to countries run by authoritarian regimes.
We didn't deport people to Cuba on a regular basis before. That has changed. We didn't think it was wise to send people back to Venezuela. Based on all the changes that President Trump is making, he must think that things are perfectly fine in Cuba and Venezuela.
The concerns about deportations and policies like the travel ban imposed on Haiti and the partial ban imposed on Cuba and Venezuela may be denting Trump's support among Hispanics in Florida, but many are doubtful it will have a lasting impact. Ninoska Perez, a prominent Cuban-American talk show host in Miami, says many who call into her daily radio show believe the immigration crackdown was overdue.
I think President Trump has a mandate that was given to him in this election, saying that he has to protect the borders, and this is one way to do it.
In the last week, some prominent Cuban-American elected officials have begun to express concerns about the administration's actions. On social media, Florida Republican State Senator Ileana Garcia posted a series of statements criticizing the Trump administration, singling out White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, the architect of Trump's immigration policy. Garcia, a longtime Trump supporter who founded Latinas for Trump, called the deportations, quote, unacceptable and inhumane. She didn't respond to interview requests. Republican Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar, also from Miami, has expressed similar concerns about the crackdown, saying deportations of Cubans, Venezuelans, and Nicaraguans have left her heartbroken. She says she and other Cuban-American members of Congress are meeting this week with Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to talk about it. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Federal workers do critical work that Americans depend on. Think taxes, Medicare, Social Security. Now, these are not always the most exciting jobs, nor the best paid. Still, many stay for decades because of what comes at the end. Excellent retirement benefits. Now, Congress may be chipping away at those, as NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
Michelle Santamaria was 18 when she landed a job with the Social Security Administration in 1990.
I started pretty much right out of high school, so about a year out of high school.
She answered phones, sorted the mail, then worked her way up to customer service and then claims specialist, where she helped people with all kinds of claims.
Retirement claims, survivor claims, family claims, disability claims.
Eventually, she became a claims technical expert, training others and working on complicated cases. The work, she says, was hard. Antiquated computer systems added to the tedium.
You know, it's a thankless job sometimes, but we're going to stick it out because we believe in what we do. And yes, we want to get to that finish line.
The finish line being retirement. Typically after 30 years, federal workers who are at least 57 can retire with excellent benefits for life.
It was the reason why I stayed so long.
But now, as part of President Trump's tax and spending bill, the House has voted to end one part of the government's retirement package, something called the Special Retirement Supplement. It's aimed at federal workers who retire before they're old enough to collect Social Security. The way it works is, at 57, they start collecting a portion of the Social Security they'd be entitled to at 62. But now that could be gone. Santa Maria heard about this last month.
I was in shock, and I thought to myself, there's no way they're going to do this to us.
Especially to those in her shoes. She just retired in April at age 53, earlier than she'd wanted to, after being offered an early out. She feared getting fired in President Trump's downsizing of the government. Now, if the Senate agrees to this benefit cut, Santa Maria estimates she'll lose a total of $110,000 that she'd been counting on for her retirement.
So it puts me in a really bad situation.
The White House did not answer NPR's questions about the proposed cut. On the other side of this debate is Rachel Gressler with the Conservative Heritage Foundation. She's long argued that the government's retirement package is unnecessarily generous, far outstripping what most Americans get. And the Special Retirement Supplement?
This really is a purely windfall benefit.
In her view, why should taxpayers give federal employees access to Social Security benefits long before everyone else? And Gressler also thinks maybe those retirement perks are keeping too many federal workers locked in.
That might be a good thing if you're retaining the right workers, but it might not be a good thing if you're preventing people from pursuing something that they would be better at.
Gressler says having people cycle in and out can be helpful. It certainly happens in the private sector. Maybe it'd be good for government. Michelle Santa Maria disagrees. She says Americans need civil servants who can expertly navigate the government's complicated systems.
If people are going to come in for 3 to 5 years, the quality, it's not going to be there.
Santa Maria actually voted for Trump. She'd hoped that DOGE would come in and upgrade their computer systems, help them work more efficiently.
But what they're doing now is just eliminating the people and leaving the rest with the outdated computer system.
And now, with part of her retirement on the chopping block, she's even more disappointed. She says if this administration wants to change things up for newer hires, okay, those people have time to adjust their plans. But for the thousands of people like her who've served for decades,
the government should keep its promise to us.
She says we've dedicated our lives to the American people. Give us what we've earned. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Total Wine & More, for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina, available to adults 21 or older. From EBSCO, committed to upholding the principles of responsible research as they work to develop AI technologies to enhance research around the world. Learn more at EBSCO.com.
I feel like blowing my horn.